This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning, everybody. Richard Martin here from the Wake Up Call. I hope you're all getting ready to have a nice weekend, a lot nicer, frankly, than the economy that you all live in. I have to tell you, we have never in our lifetime seen a financial and economic bust such as the one we've just had. We have never had two great asset bubbles break in the same decade. We've never wiped out so much wealth in all asset classes as we have this time. That's $20 trillion at its worst point, by my reckoning. We've never experienced such rapid deterioration in the government's budget and in the balance sheet of the Fed, nor witnessed such moral havoc with bailouts flying around like this. So I ask you, what hope do we really have in making accurate predictions of how the world will recover from all of this? Well, Harrisburg, the capital of Pennsylvania, said it should skip a $2.2 million debt service payment and consider bankruptcy, according to the city controller, Don Miller. Sales of previously occupied homes took the largest monthly drop in more than 40 years last month, sinking more dramatically than expected after lawmakers gave buyers additional time to use a tax credit. U.S. consumers defaulted on store brand credit cards at near record levels during the holiday shopping season, with 2010 likely to bring more of the same, according to Fitch Ratings. So far, 25 states have borrowed more than $25 billion to keep benefits flowing after their trust funds ran dry. And in many other states, the situation is deteriorating fast. Well, according to Pete DuPont, chairman of the National Center for Policy Analysis and a former governor of Delaware, and I quote, "Even if Congress does nothing, tax hikes will hit hard a year from now." Nearly one in five U.S. households ran out of money to buy enough food at least once during 2009, and that's according to the anti-hunger group Food Research and Action Center. This came out, according to them, on Tuesday. Well, Barron's magazine printed the first part of its annual roundtable discussion of 2010 this past week. This is an annual, very important discussion between some of the so-called brightest minds on Wall Street. Many of the participants were very concerned about the debt, mostly government debt. Well, probably total debt is a much more useful metric. Mark Farber, in fact, talked about a 7,000-word New York Times article by Professor Paul Krugman. He stated that the article, "How Did Economists Get It So Wrong?" never mentioned that excessive credit growth or leverage was the cause of monetary instability and brought about the financial crisis. Bill Gross stated that by lowering interest rates, we promote consumption instead of manufacturing. Central bankers were forced to respond with liquidity to a problem that developed over the past 25 years. There was more discussion of credit growth, which of course is another way to say debt growth, in the macro analysis that's always presented in the first part of the three Barron's articles of the round table. Well, the amazing thing to me is that most of these round table participants seem to understand the same problems that I talk about almost every week, yet they are all very positive on the stock market for 2010. And this, by the way, in tradition, has it that the more that the participants look in one direction, the more likely it is that the market will go in the other direction. That's a fairly standard and fairly reliable guide. So those of us who are bearish have going for us on our side. Well, it seems that most of the roundtable participants understand the debt problem that I've been talking about for the past 4 years. The worst period of the debt explosion started with the outrageous internet bubble in the late 1990s, continuing through the correction in the internet bubble and then the housing bubble, which should have been obvious to everyone, even the Fed, and then, of course, finally the Fed financial crisis of 2008. Well, it's astounding to think that the stock market has been in its own kind of mini-bubble up until now. I did expect the rebound from a very oversold market in March of 2009, but certainly not a 70% rebound from the lows. I actually don't think it's possible to fool the investors in the stock market one more time, especially this close to the 2003 to 2007 and 1996 to 2000 bubbles. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I've said this before, but until balance sheets are repaired, the stock market cannot do well, and the secular bear market will continue. You know, I just cannot fathom why these round table participants, or virtually anyone else, that matter, do not bring up the fact that the total debt in the United States doubled from 2000 to the present, from $26 trillion to $53 trillion. And this drove the debt, both public and private, to 375% of GDP in the States, before recently declining to 370%. And by the way, as I mentioned before, this 375% number is the highest since the Great Depression, when it reached 260% at the peak, even with a collapsing GDP. Even more incredible is that the present debt level does not include the entitlement and pension obligations that would just about double the total debt from where it is now. As U.S. debt to GDP started accelerating in the 1960s with the Vietnam War, the space race, and continuation of the Cold War, when it took $1.53 to generate an additional $1 of GDP. Now, to understand very clearly, I've mentioned this before, ladies and gentlemen, understand what that means. It means that when a businessman scratches his head and says, I want to make more money, and he goes to his bank, and he borrows $1.53, he can expect it to produce an additional dollar's worth of earnings. That was in the 1960s. And then during the 1970s, with the continuation of the Vietnam War, it took $1.68 to generate $1 of GDP, just a few cents more. Now, fast forward to the 1980s, including leveraged buyouts and Star Wars, it took $2.93. Now we're talking about the businessman borrowing $2.93 from his bank to create just $1 of earnings. In the 1990s, with the internet bubble, the debt it took to generate $1 of GDP climbed to $3.12. However, the most incredible of all was the first decade of century when it took over $6 to generate an additional $1 of GDP. That decade included the war on terror, two wars, private equity firms, which by the way is the new name, leveraged buyouts, and housing and another market bubble, as well as promises of entitlements that we have no possibility of ever being able to keep. Now, I'm sure you understand, ladies and gentlemen, needing over $6 to generate $1 of gross domestic product is unsustainable. So as high as the U.S. GDP debt to GDP number is, believe it or not, it isn't even as bad as in many other countries. And that's according to a report made by Kinsey Global Institute. The U.K. debt to GDP is about 470%. Japan's 460%. Spain is 340%, South Korea 340%, Switzerland 315%, France and Italy both about 300%, Germany 275%, and Canada 205%. All of those, of course, are the records of debt to GDP. Well, the McKinsey report agrees, obviously, that the deleveraging will be very painful and take years to resolve. When you hear these things, when you hear me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, it takes $6 for the average business person to borrow and know that it will generate just $1 of return. It is clearly a crisis which is about to break open in the most horrible way. But you will not read about that. You will read the figures, yes, but you will not read the emphasis of the explanation of what this means. You know, you may think that since China and the other BRIC countries are not as leveraged as the more developed countries, that they could grow enough to put the global economy. But you have to remember that McKinsey report was 2008. Had a stimulus package that was three times the size of the U.S. stimulus package relative to GDP. It means that the U.S. stimulus package of $787 billion would have been over $2 trillion if the U.S. had had a package as large as China. Also, the Chinese government encouraged bank lending, and banks were loaning out $1.3 trillion during 2009. They could now be more leveraged than the United States. China obviously can be the next bubble as they are building up their economy to sell products to a world that is deleveraging. And the deleveraging of America, as well as many other countries, will be the primary focus of central banks worldwide, not the escape from the financial crisis, not the earnings that are supported by cost-cutting, and not the economic rebound supported by the stimulus and inventory rebuild. The deleveraging of America and much of the global economy will trump everything else. And I'm sure you understand what I mean by deleveraging, the idea that Piper is being paid, the debts are being paid down or defaulted on. In other words, the leveraging of the average balance sheet with debt that's been taken out wantonly and without any regard for the future has hit a brick wall. And either deleveraging takes place or bankruptcy or both. That's what's meant by deleveraging. That is what will occupy the minds and hearts of people for years to come. See, in the past, when a nation's total debt rose to unsustainable levels, it would just debase its currency enough to try to export its way to prosperity, and even this didn't always work. However, when all its major trading partners also need to debase their currency, as of today, it becomes, of course, an impossible task. And this, of course, takes us directly to the cycle of deflation, which must figure in every discussion of this debt problem. We are still in the competitive devaluation part of the cycle. However, you can only devalue or debase your currency relative to other countries in order to gain a competitive advantage. And when all of your trading partners are in the same boat as you, then you are forced to take more drastic measures, and that brings you down the cycle of deflation to better thy neighbor policies. This essentially means that the country in trouble will do whatever it takes to sell its products abroad. When a country needs to keep its plants open, it might have to sell its products at less than cost or put restrictive tariffs on imports and or subsidize exports. So you understand now, with all this debt, ladies and gentlemen, with all this huge debt to gross domestic product, only deleveraging can take us out of this mess, and that has to take place in the context of deflation. Deflation meaning that everything comes down in value and in price. This seems to me so blindingly obvious that it takes only a moron with half a brain cell to think that inflation could actually even exist in the vocabulary. And yet you have all these people running around and telling you that, you know, commodity prices are going to soar, that gold is going to soar, that inflation is in our future. Where do they get this information? I am not aware of any coherent argument that I have ever read in the last 3 years that convinces me that inflation has any meaning. It just cannot exist in this kind of over-indebted environment. But I cannot emphasize enough that the total debt to GDP is so onerous for the economies of the most mature countries, as well as China, that the global economy will suffer tremendously over the next few years. You know, we have discussed this over and over again, and in fact, with a little tongue-in-cheek, I stated in many of these talks that when Obama realizes what he inherited, he will demand a recount of the 2008 election. The masses don't trust the liberals, and they don't trust the conservatives. They don't like the Democrats, and they don't like the Republicans. They don't like any institution, whether it's government, journalism, or anything else. They just want things to change. And if you take Obama's State of the Union speech of 2 nights ago, there is no change inherent in anything he said. The poor man is clueless. He should have been an actor. He'd have trumped Reagan. He wouldn't have been a B actor. He would have been an A actor. His delivery is superb. Unfortunately, the content is an F. You know, the regulation of the banking industry, the tea parties, the populist demands, the election in Massachusetts, the health care reform, even the employment situation, all take a back seat to the enormous amount of this debt relative to GDP. The masses want to change because of the pain they've been going through presently, and they just don't understand the invisible hand of the interest on the debt, absorbing so many dollars that could have been used to support the economy. And this invisible hand is causing the masses to want change, even though they don't understand why they feel so uncomfortable. And they don't know who is to blame. They're just mad as hell and can't take it anymore, from the movie Network. All of this causes the deleveraging as the private sector pays down debt or defaults. This process is very painful, and it will take many years to resolve. The process has already started in business loans and consumer credit, which are shrinking at record rates while the government debt is expanding at record rates. This deleveraging will take place on a global scale and will take many, many years to resolve. Japan has already suffered 2 lost decades and has still not solved the problem. Well, this will take place globally and it will continue to be painful. There is no way, ladies and gentlemen, that this deleveraging process and the consequences of that process can be avoided. Okay, well, this is Richard Martin, the wake-up call, and it is time for you, as always, to call in, ask your questions, and please let your views be known. The number to call in is 888-873-4643. Once again, 888-873-4643. If you would like to send an email instead of calling in, most people seem to do that. It'd be nice if they called, but anyway, if you want to do that, you can do it, and you can write to me at rm@gfawd.com. Once more, it's RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD or Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design.com. Okay, once more, RM@gfawd.com. And as always, if you want to call me with your questions in private, your private situation, your financial situation, you can do that too. My direct line here in Singapore through Sarasota, Florida is area code 941-441-1682. Call me anytime. I'd be glad to talk to you, and I will do what I can to assist you with your conundrums. Well, I suppose it's conundrum. Anyway, once again, the number is 941-441-1682. I think what's different now is that the government has to sell more debt this year than ever before. And it's painfully obvious that there are no legitimate buyers left for that debt. So the only choices are for the Fed to buy it with freshly minted dross paper, otherwise known as dollars, or for the government to force Americans to buy it by confiscating their 401ks, which I don't think will happen, by the way, right away, but it is something to be thinking about, as I mentioned before, and I will keep an eye on it and keep you informed. I'm sure, one way or the other, that the debt will be bought, but then what happens next year? You see, we're reaching the tipping point where we either fall into a hyperinflationary situation where the Fed is buying every penny of the debt the government puts out, which I don't think is going to happen, or we fall into a debt collapse situation where the government defaults on its debt, which is much, much more likely. They're pushing the system as far as they can get away with. They haven't even begun to reverse the debt insanity. In fact, they're expanding it. And if you think things are bad now, you won't believe how bad they will get when this course actually reverses. Unfortunately, the Great Depression is nothing compared to what is headed our way. We've been churning for the last decade, but we haven't even begun to correct what got us here in the first place. The pain is already approaching the levels of the bottom of the Great Depression, as we're seeing unemployment about 17%, basis the U6 estimate, while in the Depression they got to 25%. But we haven't seen an overall debt contraction yet, and when it does finally arrive, I wouldn't be surprised to see unemployment approach the 50% mark. Well, dear Mr. Bernanke, he kept his job, didn't he? More's the pity. His thesis is utterly flawed. You'll do this country no good. But then, of course, he doesn't represent the people of the country, does he? As it was so eloquently explained on television the other day, in terms of Zeitner representing the bankers that elected him when he was the Fed governor of New York. Bernanke, of course, is in the same situation. His interests are not those of the country. And I think it's useful to keep in mind, by the way, why central banking got started in the first place. It actually got started to circumvent people's understandable reluctance to lend to the sovereign. King William III was broke and no one, bank or individual, would lend to him. In fact, some Scottish banking promoters stepped forward and offered to lend him in exchange for favors granted to them and denied to other bankers. And the biggest privilege they asked for was the right to be the sole issuer of banknotes within 65 miles of London. All about the nerve. They intended to muzzle all other London banks and take their lending business for themselves. And this was a straightforward mercantilist proposal, no different from hundreds of others. Even the button makers had their special arrangement with the king. Well, the deal was made and the Bank of England came into existence. The bank promptly issued a flood of banknotes, but was insolvent within 2 years when the regional banks turned in the notes for gold. What a delicious revenge that must have been. Well, recapitalized, the bank, of course, is still with us. The bank wasn't founded to be the lender of last resort to other banks to ensure full employment, to hit CPI numbers, or to stimulate economies. All that came later. But governments everywhere, then and now, and for all time, are not creditworthy. They don't make profits, and they can't pay you back. They shouldn't really be carrying any debt at all. Under 100% reserve banking, or even under free banking, this fact would never be lost sight of and would be common knowledge. Central banking enables governments to embark on Ponzi financing to create the illusion of creditworthiness and to swell with authority and control, perhaps for a very long time. But reality never goes away, and eventually their true condition becomes apparent. Bust. Well, the Brookings Institution came out with a warning yesterday. It said that 30% of the nation was either in poverty already or headed to it. The U.S. is becoming like a developing nation, according to the report, with 39.1 million people living in poverty. Many cities, by the way, have already reached the 30% poverty rate, including Cleveland, Detroit, Youngstown, Buffalo, Syracuse, Dayton, and Hartford, Connecticut. But according to the report, the poverty is increasing fastest in the suburbs. Well, according to thenation.com, I thought it was an interesting description here. They say, and I quote, "There's a Mad Max feeling to daily life in many neighborhoods. The Central Valley has a swath of cities whose home foreclosure rates rank in the top 10 in the country. Friends looking to buy a home in a poor part of Sacramento tell me of foreclosed houses stripped of their copper wires, their toilets, their pipes, even their drywall. An ex-student reports visiting homes in which furious foreclosed owners and evicted tenants have urinated and defecated on the carpeting, abandoned pets to starve, left chins filled with rotting food. Sure, you can buy these properties for next to nothing, but you'll have to bring in the biohazard squads before you can safely occupy them. University departments looking to pinch pennies, removing their professors' office phones. Judges in some counties have donated a percentage of their salaries back to the courts so that the courts will have enough money to stay open. And on furlough Fridays, downtown Sacramento, the capital city of the world's eighth largest economy, is practically a ghost town. The restaurants are empty, the streets quiet, nobody is at work." Well, as the current deflationary forces go stronger over the next few months and years, you're going to see stock markets crashing around the world, real estate prices falling further, commodities, including oil and gold, yes, gold, drop substantially in price, and most bonds will tank as countries default. Many businesses, including banks, will go under. So I really doubt if anyone will be investing in expensive green technology with oil under $50 or maybe $30 a barrel. People would not be buying new iPods or other frivolous technology with the money they do not have and the credit they cannot get. Don't expect the U.S. government, or any government for that matter, to come to the rescue. They simply cannot stop real depressions caused by latent deflationary forces. They can prolong them and make them worse with foolish spending, as in the 1930s, and they can try to find scapegoats for their own stupidity. But you know, depressions end when depressions end, and that's when the debt leveraging is finished. By the way, Europeans do happen to have the most advanced nuclear power plants, the most advanced wind turbines, the most advanced non-conventional energy technology, the most advanced tunnels, the most advanced rail systems, the fanciest satellites. The Europeans are able to dominate the export of these products while the U.S. just keeps talking. Oh yes, do I need to mention that the most advanced nuclear research facility in the world, the Large Hadron Collider, the Ariane V heavy launch rocket, which has taken just about the entire launch business away from the U.S.? There is one industry where the U.S. is superior, so superior that it dominates the world market, and that's military equipment. You know, while the U.S. doesn't sell aircraft carriers, it makes and sells an awful lot of other killing machines. Yep, U.S. killing machines deliver superior skills of human beings. Untold billions go into R&D in the killing industry. The trouble is, of course, that the output, all those high-tech missiles and such, just kind of sit there looking for wars, which delivers absolutely zero economic or financial return. All right, well, Henry from the Bronx is ready to ask a question. Henry, stay there. Hang in there. We're going to take a break. Right now, as soon as we get back from the break, Henry, you will be the star performer here.
You are listening to Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
This is Peter Roth, the host of Energy Stew on Thursday nights at 7:30. The show is about life's patterns, how they influence our lives, and how our own patterns influence life around us. It's about knowing ourselves better and understanding the mechanics of our life journey. We have wonderful guests who have made great contributions to the knowledge of ourselves. Tune in on Thursday evenings at 7:30 for Energy Stew on Progressive Radio Network.
Join us, Bruce and Marianne Curtis, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Truth and Freedom. We present provocative conversations with the world's most brilliant minds in the areas of holistic health, spiritual wisdom, politics, and a host of other topics. Some of our topics include the latest work in non-invasive therapy on the brain, the truth beneath the global economic meltdown, healing power of the breath, and the sublime truth beyond all religious traditions. In this age of transformation, we need to look beneath the surface appearance of things to see the underlying reality. From material that is always illuminating and often liberating, tune in to Truth and Freedom on the Progressive Radio Network Fridays at 3 p.m.
Listen to Of Consuming Interest every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Jim Turner, attorney in Washington, D.C., chairman of the board of Citizens for Health. Every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, we discuss a topic of consuming interest, often about health, but also about politics, commerce, and whatever the current topic of the day might be. Of Consuming Interest, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, on the Progressive Radio Network.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Well, I guess we're back, and Henry hopefully is standing by to talk to us. Hello, Henry.
Oh, hi, Richard. Good morning.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you.
Yeah, so what have you got on your mind, Henry?
Okay. I've been brainstorming a few things, and I figured I wanted to share it with you and the audience. And it's really one of the hidden reasons, I think, that the economy as the basically the Anglo-Saxon countries is really have no hope. And when I say no hope, I mean what I think is they will not really ever truly recover to be a real prosperous economy anymore based on their model. And it's strictly mathematical. And when I say mathematical, I mean what we have, especially in the United States and Britain, to a certain level, and even France, is the unused capacity of these countries that remain, when I say unused, idle and deliberately idled. For instance, in the United States, there is a section of the population that's unemployed, will not be employed, will not be trained to employ, and it's deliberately done by the general society, and people in your audience and will never admit it. Well, what the country has done, for the most part, since probably emancipation or after that, they've literally, you know, when you have a factory and you have a capacity of 100% and you decide, well, I'll leave 12% idle. I will not use it. I will not develop it. I will leave it there to Miranda. And what they've done is mathematically, they're probably not realizing it. They've made the calculation. As long as the factory remains competitive and it is profitable enough to survive, everything is okay for that 12% to be unproductive. In other words, you don't use the whatever your machineries are, you won't develop it, you won't improve it, you just leave it there idle. It's okay because we can still operate on that 88% as long as we make enough profit that we can survive. Well, what happens now is that 88% that's being used is technically being used in all sorts of ways, and what happens when things go wrong is that now we'll say we have a 5% unemployment. Hey, things are going right. We don't really have 5% unemployment. The true employment, if you count the other 12% of your factory that's not utilized, you really have a 17%. But it's not counted, it's not factored in very much. What happens now is when you get a 10% unemployment, you really don't have 10% employment. Your factory is not working at 10% less of the 90%. It's really working at 10% from that 78%. You know,
I'm sorry to interrupt you here, Henry. I need to understand, why are we keeping aside 12%? I mean, what's the point of this factory by not using 12%?
That is the point, Rich. The point is a certain segment of the population is never developed. Their minds, their intellectual ability has been ignored. Sometimes it's safe to put a few of them in prisons and stuff like that. In other words, for a business or any entity to improve, you must use your entire 100% capacity to develop whatever area of it is best usable to make your business survive. But many of these industrial countries have left numerous portion of the population underutilized, undereducated, and deliberately has done it, ignored it, and done all these studies and camouflage. That's what I meant. I didn't want to refer to it as a population. I'm just using a mathematical model. But that is been done in France, in Europe, or wherever the immigrants are from, or whatever, what section of the population they are. These are people that could be productive. That's not being channeled. In other words, the preferred class of the population gets the work, gets the education, gets the system, and there's this unused, untapped 12% or 15%
Henry,
in some states that's not utilized.
Henry, isn't this largely because the Eastern countries have taken the productive capacity away from these people in the West? It isn't.
In previous years, if 250 years ago, those people were unemployed. Most of those people were productive workers; they just weren't being paid. They were the production core. But 200 years later, most of those people are not utilized anymore. I think most of these countries made a calculated mistake. They do not.
Well, that's because inflation has priced out the Western countries from the market. Now, where before people could produce in these countries competitively with anybody in the world, what's happened now is that inflation over the 1970s and onwards simply priced the West out of the market. And the Asian countries, you know, countries like China and India and Korea and now, of course, Vietnam is coming on. All these countries found themselves able to produce the kind of things that the West buys for a tenth of the price of what the West could produce them for. So, of course, they're idle, and of course they're not working in the factories, and there's tremendous unused capacity in the Western countries.
What I really meant was I've used the mathematical formula in terms of a factory as an analysis, not a particular factory. But I was just saying, well, if you look at a factory as you look at a country. So, in other words, I'm transforming a country to a factory, and I say mathematically, you're not using 10% of your factory. In other words, you're not using 10% of your population. You're not developing.
Yes.
In China, they have a model which is quite to the contrary. They use maybe 98% of it, but their 2% is in prison doing productive work. In other words, they don't have the moral thing to say, well, okay, we'll not use prisoners for manufacturing. In other words, they use that 2% to work in a factory, make buttons, make shirts, make this, make all sort of stuff.
It's an interesting concept that you come up with, Henry. It's interesting. It's certainly a new departure, and I guess it's worth considering. You know,
that have been made in many countries because what they've done is that here are these people, whether they are from Eastern Europe, whatever they are from, but when you move from one productive sector to another, whether it's manufacturing or agriculture. If you go from agriculture, which most economies were in previous years, those people were doing the manufacturing. They were like the mill or the driving machine behind the economy. They were farmers, sharecroppers, whatever they did. But now they're idle, collecting what you call siphons, are a little enough to stay alive, but not being utilized. In other words, you're not utilizing that 12 or 10% of that factory that could have been. You could get 5% more out of that 12%. That would have been. And so when you have a drop in the economy now, what you have are a slowdown in the factory production. And this is just an analogy of what some countries do. The mistake they make is that, you know, when you have that drop in productivity, now you don't, you know, you don't have 90% or 95% production. You have
60%. Henry, thank you very much. Production. That's a very interesting concept, and I appreciate it. And I'm sure we will come back to that at some point in the future. Listen, thank you. Let's run now to a few of the emails that I've received. John Ilo just wrote in. He says, "Hi, Richard. I'm looking for the greatest possible profit from this upcoming downturn. I'm very comfortable with ETFs, including the 3x inverse variety, but should I look at options, Richard? Are there a way for me to increase profits either slightly or dramatically? Thank you, Richard." John, I'm afraid to say the answer has to be no. I mean, in all the time in the business that I've been trading, I have never known anybody trade options consistently with a profit. It's a horrible thing to have to say, but I've never known anybody, not one single person, and I actually was once the trader to the Enron account. Yes, indeed, the Enron account there, and they had an absolutely splendid facility up in Valhalla in upstate New York, and I went there on several occasions, and I have to tell you, it looked like an aircraft cockpit. I mean, no money was spared in putting in all the systems to trade options, and the guy made a fortune for several months, and then he lost it all in 6 weeks. Even the brightest and the best have a hard time with options. Now, I'm going to be inundated with people saying, "I've made money, and I know this person's made money." Good luck to them. I absolutely, sincerely wish people the best of luck. But options is a mug's game, John, and basically, in my estimation, then you want to stay away from it. But anyway, thank you for the email. Charles from New York City wrote in saying, "Looking at Europe today, we had the news that the UK, my home country, had finally come out of recession. It's very interesting. They bet the farm on the banking industry in a way that even the states didn't. It's very hard to see how their recovery could even be as strong as that of the United States." Charles from New York City. Well, thank you, Charles. That was an interesting comment, and I totally agree with it. People don't realize in what a very serious and parlous situation the United Kingdom is in, and I think it will be first of the major countries to default on its debt. An anonymous person wrote in saying, "Just got done getting filled in on the massive going on in my girlfriend's school district. She teaches high school. Jobs are being cut, classes consolidated, any kind of vendor-related services slashed hard. This is going on all over Colorado, and I'm sure it's worse in other states. This will add many thousands to the jobless rolls. And that's this year." She said budget shortfall projections are way too optimistic. That's why they're smashing gold, or trying anyway. They want it as low as possible before Bernanke has to announce more quantitative easing, otherwise known as money printing. "I think I have a handle, as much as anyone, on just how bad things are, but every day I get a deeper understanding that it's worse than even I think." Signed, Anonymous. Quite sobering, yeah. Frank wrote in saying, "Richard, the following is from the automaticearth.blogspot.com. I would appreciate your opinion. One thing these times have yielded is a surplus of subject matter for the wake-up call." You can say that again, Frank. There you go. Signed, From the Foxhole, Frank. So here's the article. It's not very long. "What is coming, I think, is a nominal short-term interest rate that is moderately negative, an official Fed rate rather than the market rate as at present, as the Fed follows the market. This means people will be paying to own T-bills, but this will still be one of the best options available for short-term capital preservation. The capital will be far less likely to be lost there than in a bank, and the return of capital is the most important thing. Despite a negative nominal rate, the real rate, the nominal rate minus negative inflation, will still be high as deleveraging continues and accelerates. It won't be as high as it would have been at a nominal rate of zero, but there would still be a real rate on top of the greater capital security than most other options. I think a lot of investors will be happy to buy T-bills even when the nominal rate is negative. The US dollar appreciation relative to other countries will be a significant bonus as well. Of course, cash on hand would be an even better option in terms of return because that would have a nominal rate higher than zero and therefore a higher real rate as well. The real rate will apply even outside a bank, reflecting the greater domestic purchasing power of liquidity. It isn't practical to hold really large sums of money in cash, though. The main risk for cash is reissuance of the currency in a different form. In the U.S., they wouldn't need to make conversion difficult as they did in Russia because there's not that much cash under the nation's beds, unlike in Russia, where there was a chronic mistrust of banks. Requiring people to convert would require them to reveal what they had, though, and this would probably result in windfall tax bills, i.e. extortion, for those who had been foresighted. For T-bills, the main risk is that the government could convert short-term debt instruments into long-term ones and then default on them later, like Argentina did. I think the risk of that for domestic investors is higher than for the foreign, as it is foreign bulk market participants that the government will not want to rattle for fear of losing access to international debt financing. The domestic ones could be struggling about it being their patriotic duty to invest in their country. I don't think the risk is high at the moment, which is why I still recommend them for the next couple of years. The risk is non-zero, but lower than for almost anything else in a high-risk environment. Or eventually, one will want to get into hard assets, even if asset prices still have further to fall. Liquidity could be as hard to hang on to as it sounds, and is therefore not a long-term bet. A couple of years should be enough to ride out the worst of an asset price collapse, while still being in a relatively low-risk position regarding liquidity. Okay, well, Frank, I agree. Yes, I've said this all along. You should be in T-bills, short-term treasury bills. I don't think the idea is that the government would convert short-term treasury bills into long-term ones. I think they might force convert other assets and other investments into government treasury bills. In fact, in Argentina, they did in fact convert them to short-term bills called letras. But I don't think that is necessarily the reason why you should be holding T-bills. Should hold T-bills because all other forms of deposits, in my opinion, are at grave risk of default, including corporate bonds, municipal bonds, insurance annuities. I mean, just about anything else which is pushed so hard by the financial community because they make more money personally on those investments, those things, I think, will be much more exposed to risk than T-bills, and we'll get plenty of warning if T-bills look like they're not going to be reimbursed or refunded, but I don't think that that's very likely. So yes, I definitely would. 2 years, Frank, I think that's being generous. I think it'll be longer than that. I don't think you want to hold hard assets for probably at least 3, maybe even 4 or 5 years. The deleveraging we've just been talking about, the deflation, all of these things have to take and run their course first, and it's going to take a lot longer than most people really seem to think. So, so there you go. I hope that has given you some something of an idea of what I think. All right. I wanted to talk to you about something that came up in terms of how to interpret the information that you see. And in this case, my eyes fell upon an article in the Daily Telegraph, which is a United Kingdom national newspaper, entitled Gold, It Won't Fall Below $1,000. And I thought, well, I don't agree with that, you know, necessarily, but let's read it and see what they have to say, because I'm always interested in another point of view in case, you know, I suddenly see the light and mine might be wrong. And I said to myself before reading it, I said, look, I'm going to make two bets with myself over this. First of all, they will never give a reason in the article, which I still hadn't read it at that point, still was unopened. And I said, I bet they will never give a reason why they selected the figure 1,000 as their low price, below which gold would not fall. And the second bet that I made with myself was that nothing they write in the article will have any direct correlation with the actual price movement in gold. It'll dance around the subject, and it'll talk about all sorts of things, but they won't talk about the movement. Why? Because they cannot, they know that they cannot justify any comments logically and coherently about which way the price of gold will move, because it's just not possible. Nobody can do that. Whatever view you may happen to hold about any investment over time, you cannot justify what might happen in the next 5 or 10 minutes or 5 or 10 days or hours or months. You can't do that. You can only take an average trend and hope that you are right about the long-term trend, and short-term traders will have their own metrics by which to trade in and out. But for the sake of an article where you're going to be told that gold won't fall below 1,000, you're not going to read anything about why it wouldn't move in that direction or in any other direction. So I thought, okay, armed with those two ideas, let's read the article. And it's quite short. So I'll read it, and I will comment on it as we go. By Bradley George and Daniel Sachs. This is the article. By the way, the first thing you do when you open the article is you see a massive picture in glorious Technicolor of an ingot of gold splashed across the front of the page, and the writing has to kind of fit along, squeezed alongside this huge sort of icon or worshipping the concept of gold. It looks a bit like an altar icon in a church. It's quite funny, actually. Anyway, the article goes like this. Continued strength in the U.S. dollar is likely to be painful for investors with long gold positions, as evidenced by December's fall, and strategists contend that the potential for further U.S. dollar strengthening is possible. Well, so far so good. However, in spite of gold's vulnerability to a stronger U.S. dollar, we continue to believe that gold is well supported in the current environment for the following reasons. Okay. In our view, a below-par recovery in the face of constrained consumer spending is more likely to continue to encourage gold investment due to expectations that fiscal and monetary stimulus is likely to continue to fuel large government deficits and pose risks to the longer-term value of the U.S. currency. Now, I don't understand in those three lines why gold should rise in that situation because of constrained consumer spending. That's not an argument for the rise in the price of gold. At least if it is, I don't see the connection. It's not there. And so that's the first thing. And I'm thinking, okay, if I didn't know anything about gold, and I'm someone who's trying to understand what gold might do, and I read this article, does this make sense to me? Does this make logical, simple logical sense? And I maintain that it does not. There's no logic behind the reasoning in that statement. So let's continue. Central banks have been supportive of the gold market as net buyers from the IMF. Okay. Of the IMF's 403.3 tons of authorized sales, 212 tons went to central banks in India, Sri Lanka, and Mauritius. China, another possible buyer, has yet to participate. In addition to the potential shift of central banks from being net sellers to net buyers of gold, we believe the continued weakness in real interest rates continues to provide strong support to gold prices over the medium term. Now again, it's a non sequitur. I can say, because the price of tomatoes is going down, therefore I need to fill my car with gas. You may need to fill the car with gas, and the price of potatoes and tomatoes may be going down, but the two don't rely on each other. There is a non sequitur. There is a lack of logic between the two statements. One does not depend on the other. And these statements, again, make sense on their own, but it doesn't mean that the price of gold is going to rally because there's weakness in real interest rates. And by the way, as an aside, I might ask, if all these banks are busy buying gold, why isn't the price of gold much higher than it already is? Is that not perhaps because the market is trying to tell us something? Anyway, just to continue. The yield on 10-year U.S. Treasury inflated protection securities remains under 1.5%. When money is easy and demand moves much faster than supply, prices can explode. In the 18 months from July 1978, gold prices went from $185 to $850 an ounce, equating to $2,400 in today's dollars. Well, thank you, I agree with all that, but the trouble with that argument is that inflation is not rising, and the price of these securities, as you rightly point out, remains under 1.5%. So what you don't tell me is why it might rise. You've told me that if and when it does rise, gold prices will rise, and that's very probable. But you haven't told me why the price of the securities, which is under 1.5%, is going to rise. Why didn't you tell me? Because you can't, because there's no real logical explanation. So finally, notwithstanding the growing chorus of bullish sentiment, debate remains as to how the real economic recovery is. With the fear of a significant financial crisis waning, debate is now turning again to how the recovery will play out. In almost all but a global soft landing scenario, we believe gold is likely to rally. We believe gold is likely to rally. Isn't that belief? Isn't that something you talk about in religion? Isn't it something that you just accept because it is, and because you don't have to ask any questions, you just accept the reality of something that somebody else told you? I'm sorry, I can't do that. If I'm going to buy gold, I need more than that. I need hard and fast reasons. Believing that gold is going to rally without any explanation, and by the way, you haven't provided me with any explanation, doesn't cut it for me. Sorry. With a global recovery unlikely to be smooth, the two main risks to most asset values are inflation and a weak U.S. dollar, both of which are positive for gold. True. But we haven't seen any asset values rise, and we certainly haven't seen inflation. So again, you've tricked me by giving me a true statement, but which has nothing to do with the thesis that you are propounding, which is that the price of gold is going to rally. So finally he says, safe haven buying as an alternative currency is set to continue in our view. However, gold is the only currency whose production is going down rather than up in double digits. No supply response to high gold prices is anticipated, and mine production is on a declining trend of approximately -1% a year, all of which absolutely true. Still doesn't tell me why the price of gold is going to go up. So I mention this all to you, ladies and gentlemen, because I want you to be very clear about this. When you read things in the papers or listen to them on the TV or the radio, or you have any inclination to try to understand something, make sure it makes sense. If it doesn't make sense, go on questioning the hypothesis. Okay? Well, come to an end of another session, and I've enjoyed talking to you, and thank you, Henry, for your participation and all those who've written in. This is Richard Martin. We'll be back on Friday, same time, same place, with another edition of the Wake Up Call. See you then. Bye-bye.